Have you ever paid attention to a lot of the warning labels that are on the products that we buy? See, the scary thing about, when you go home, you'll find some warning labels. The scary thing about warning labels on the different products that we have is that the warning label exists for the sheer reason, most likely on them, that somebody did the very thing that the warning label tells you not to do. Okay? So as you're reading warning labels, think of that. All right? But this morning, I want to share with you some of my very favorite warning labels in all the world. And this first one is from an iron. And on the warning label of this iron, it says, warning, do not iron your clothes while they're on your body. Some of you may be tempted to do that to save time. It's not a good idea. This other one with a push mower, this morning came with a push mower. It's caution, do not use push mower to mow, to trim your hedges. My goodness. I should just read off the screen here. Not for use as a hedge trimmer. That's the warning there. Don't do that. It's a bad idea. here's a blanket. Not to be used as protection from tornado, all right? So if you're ever if there's ever a tornado in your area, don't hide under a blanket. It's not going to do a lot of good for you. On a Superman costume, warning, cape does not enable user to fly, all right? So don't go try to fly by a Superman costume. It's not going to work. Every time I think of this one, I laugh. It's one of my favorites, which gives you a sense of my sick and twisted sense of humor. Remember that each of these warning labels exists because somebody did the very thing that they're not supposed to do, okay? So this next warning label is found on a microwave oven, and it's simply this, do not use for drying pets, all right? It's a really bad, don't try it at home, don't think about it. Maybe it was the dog with the Superman costume, he tried to fly and fell in some water, and they tried to dry him off. It's a really bad idea, all right? Just don't even go there. But this last one, it really resonates with me. It really resonates with me because I'm from Arizona, as I told you a little bit earlier, and everybody in Arizona, many of you perhaps, have those little sunshades in your car, you know, that you use in the front windshield to keep the sun from baking the inside of your car. And if you go out to your car after this and it's up, before you fold it up, or if it's one of those little round ones that you can't fold up and you just give up and throw it in the back seat, before you do whatever it is that you're going to do, look at the warning label on there, and chances are it says something like this, do not drive with sunshield in place. All right? It's a bad idea. It's just, see, the scary thing is I'm related to people that this warning was written for. The reason that warning is there is because if you and I drive with the sun shield in place, who can tell me what's going to happen? You're going to crash. You're going to run into something. It's not a good idea. The sunshade is there to keep the sun out, but it also keeps you from seeing out. So it's a really good idea not to drive with the sunshade in place, because eventually you're going to head for a crash. The same is true for you and I as we discover more about our relationship with Jesus and where he's leading us in the journey that we're on. I'm making an assumption this morning, and those are dangerous things, but I'm going to tell you what it is. And it's that if you are here in this place today, you fit somewhere within the following spectrum. On one end, you have heard about Jesus, you're curious about him, you want to know more about Jesus and the church thing. On the other end of that same spectrum, you have met Jesus. He has radically changed your life. You know how incredibly awesome he is, and you're here because you're fellowshipping with other believers, hearing from his word, and you love him with all your heart. You're getting ready for glory someday. Somewhere, each of us, I believe, is somewhere in that spectrum. And so with that in mind, if we're in that spectrum, then all of us, to some extent, are on the same journey. And as we're on that journey, one of the most dangerous things that we can do as individual followers of Jesus is when it comes to the journey he has us on, drive with the sunshade in place. Because you see, there are certain things that block our view of God. They kind of creep up in life and they block our view of who God is and what he's desiring to do in and through us. I'm really excited to know about what you have been going through this summer as a local church with your M3 emphasis. That's so exciting. Because as you catch the wind of God's Spirit and do the things that he leads you to do as a missional and multiplying local church, the world around you will change. And I caution you, as you pursue this, first of all, count the cost. Secondarily, pray up. really hard. Because one of the most dangerous things, or perhaps the most dangerous thing to the kingdom of hell, is a missional and multiplying church. And the enemy doesn't like it very much. So I hope you're praying hard for your church and your pastors and this emphasis as it comes our way. But the truth is, as you discover more of what it is to pursue Christ's kingdom rather than your own, you're going to discover that there are things we allow to block our view of God and get in the way of where He's leading. And the scary thing is, some of us can get really good at driving with the sunshade up. The problem is, we're eventually headed for the same end. We're eventually headed for a crash if we keep driving with the sunshade up. We're going to be in Luke chapter 14 this morning. You can turn there in your scriptures if you have them with you. I think you have some Bibles before you in the pews as well. Luke chapter 14 contains a series of discussions with Jesus and some of those who are around him. And one of the main themes throughout the chapter is this very subject of some of the things that can block our view of God and the journey he has us on. Some of the things that get in the way. Why is that so important? Well, as I said, we're headed for a crash. But the issue at hand is when you and I crash, it doesn't just affect you and me. It doesn't affect the person sitting next to you. In fact, Jesus says that the church acts like this. He is the vine and we are the branches. That he is the head and we are the body. And if that is true, and I believe that it is, then you and I are connected to every believer in every place. That what happens to you and to Armbrist Wesleyan Church affects not just the people here, and not just the church down the road, and not just the churches in Western Pennsylvania or Pennsylvania, and not just the churches in North America or the Western Hemisphere. It affects every believer everywhere somehow. Good. Preach. I'm just kind of, I think the chickens were a little more animated, all right? I know, you're just listening real good. It's okay. So if that's the case, then we need to be cautious. This idea that we need to be pointedly careful in how we live for God, that we need to be aware of the things that can block our vision, is nothing new. In fact, you don't need to turn there, but in the very last chapter of Joshua, the namesake of that book is about to lead the people of God into the land that has been promised to them for generations. They've gone in and they have conquered the land. They've already fought all those big battles like Jericho and things like that. They have wandered the desert as a nation for years and years. They've conquered the land, and as they're getting ready to finally settle in the place that God has promised them, he tells them this: be very careful to obey the Lord your God. Another translation says, be very careful to love the Lord your God. It's a warning that we would do well to heed today. Why is he warning them of that? I believe it's because he knows that since time immemorial, since humanity fell in the Garden of Eden, we have been tempted to allow various things to block our view of God, to block our view of the journey that he has us on. And when we do that, we crash. And so today, we're going to look at what it is that we can do, or what those things are, and get some tools to keep them from creeping up. Are you in Luke chapter 14 yet? If you aren't, you'll never, ever find it. So you should just, you know, look at me and listen, okay? So we're in Luke 14, and I'm going to read to you the first six verses. The first thing that Jesus talks about that can block our view is the sunshade, the visor, if you will, of religion. In 14, the first verse, it says, "One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. Then, there in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body." In other words, he was in a great deal of pain. "Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?' But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, 'If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?' And they had nothing to say." I want you to know, we're going to read most of the 14th chapter. The parts that we don't read, it's not that we're not reading them because they're not important. It's just that for time's sake, we're kind of pushing through, okay? keep in mind that Jesus lived in the ancient world. He lived in the first century as a Jew in what is now the Israel area in ancient Palestine. And as he was living in that era, oratory and teaching were very, very important. Teachers were very high on the social totem pole. And how you interacted with teachers is also very important. So what happens here is we see Jesus poses a question to those who he knows are already questioning him. And when they fail to give an answer, at least, at the very least, they're saying that they've just been bested in an argument. There's no retort. On the other end of that, they're saying that somehow their scheme of looking at this current problem, of this current situation, is wrong. And that's huge. Now, it helps us if we understand a little bit about this group called the Pharisees. This group, they were around, obviously, at the same time of Jesus. And kind of central to their belief was that the rescuer God had promised their people, they've been oppressed for years and years and years, and there's this government called the Roman government. You've probably heard about them. They were kind of a big deal back in the day. They're kind of oppressing them. They're setting up their own government over the Jews. And so this group called the Pharisees, they believe that if they can just get everybody to behave for a single day, if they can have an uninterrupted day of everybody behaving according to the law, then the promised one will come. The rescuer will come and begin to set everything right. This is what this group believes. But what we can see in their interaction with Jesus is that their focus on religion, on this the legalism that they pursued, and they were very legalistic, they were so caught up in their legalism that they missed the very one that they were waiting for. They were so caught up in religion that their vision was blocked to the fact that the rescuer, the hope of the world, the Messiah, was right before their eyes. And that's the insidious, dangerous thing about religion. It causes us to miss the deeper things, and the scary thing, just like for this group of people, is that it can creep in without us even recognizing that it has happened. You've heard the old expression about how you boil a frog, right? If you have the water up on high and you toss the frog in, it just tosses right back out. I mean, we're doing a lot of violence to animals in here today, aren't we? But if you have the water at room temperature and slowly allow the water to heat, the frog will die. That's kind of how religion is. We allow ourselves to get comfortable and to steep and to stew, and eventually we're blind and we're dead of heart, not even realizing that it has happened. It happened to these religious leaders here. So we need to be extra careful that this thing of religion doesn't block our view of God. And that's not to say that the things of the past are unimportant. They are very important. And that's not to say that the things of our religion aren't good. Many and most of them are very good. But the issue is when we begin to pursue the rites and regulations and the things of the past rather than the King of the ages, rather than the one who is bringing his kingdom, sure as we're all sitting here, when we do that, we're much more like these Pharisees than we would ever care to admit. And our heart needs a quick check. In fact, Jesus tells us in his word that one day he will call everybody together. And there will be people who were very religious, who did all the right stuff. And his response to them will be, "Depart from me, I never knew you." It's one of those more haunting passages of Scripture. And I don't mean to be a downer this morning, but this is really important. If we can't deal with these things as individuals and as a local church, especially as we pursue, again, catching the wind of God's Spirit and going where He leads us, we're in big trouble. You know, the next thing that seems to be in this passage before us, Jesus says that our own pride can get in the way, and He says that in a certain way here in verses 7 and following. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, Jesus told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast,
do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place. So when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. The truth is, we often do a lot of what we do to be seen by others. So everybody else can know just how important we are, how successful we are, how self-sufficient we are, how self-made we are, how we picked ourselves up by the bootstraps and got where we are today. But the thing is, in Jesus, all of those things must die. Jesus says if we try to make ourselves look bigger, better, higher, he will bring us down. We'll be less than. We'll be humbled. Throughout this whole passage, this theme of pride and humility is one of the threads running throughout. And immediately following what we've just read, Jesus tells his hearers that if they're throwing a feast, they should invite the least important people. Now, we don't live in that time, so it's really hard to understand, but that would be a humiliating thing for someone in Jesus' day to do. Because the most intimate thing you could do with someone, the highest act of friendship in Jesus' day was sharing a meal with them. And so Jesus is telling his hearers that they ought to go out of their way to be great friends, deeply intimate, with the lowest of the low in society. And the problem that that causes them is that all of the highest of the high in society won't invite them to their own parties. It's Jesus reminding them of the need to be with those who are poor and needy and lowly, because you and I, as we stand before God, we are poor and needy, and we are lowly. At the end of this passage, Jesus says that we need to carry our own cross. It's the lowest form of execution known. Basically, all of this is a call to remember, simply put, it's not about us. It's not about what we desire. It's not about our own life. It's about the life of the King in and through us. One of the greatest symptoms of pride. If you want to see if there's a symptom that this thing is blocking your vision and view of God and where he would lead you, the symptom of that is that we refuse to ask for help when we need it. And the result of not asking for help when we need it is that we create a bigger and bigger and bigger mess, when all along, all we have to do is cry out for help. Jesus also seems to indicate in this passage that our demands can somehow block our view of who he is and what he's doing. Look at chapter 14 again, obviously, verses 15 and following. When one of those at the table with him heard this, now this is that whole, you know, invite the low and the needy. When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed are those who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.' But they all began to make excuses. The first said, 'I've just bought a field and I must go and see it.' Another said, 'I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out.' Still another said, 'I just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.'" What you need to understand here is, again, we just talked a little bit about how important a feast was. And this is obviously a wealthy, wealthy man, possibly kind of an under-ruler who's inviting people to him. This is a big deal. And they all come up with the lamest excuses that you can possibly imagine. It's the kind of excuses that my wife used to give me for not going out with me. You know, I'd like to, but I have to wash my hair. my sock drawer needs to be reorganized. Guys, you've all heard it, I hope. Anyway, no, she never really did that to me. Those are bad memories from high school, I think, coming back. But they're lame excuses. The fact is that these people are telling the master, I can't come. They knew the feast was coming, and yet they're choosing the mundane rather than this incredible opportunity. The result of you and I pursuing today's demands instead of the kingdom is that we will often miss the kingdom. Because our head is down and we're doing the work and we're focusing on what is here. And that's not to say you shouldn't be diligent. You shouldn't be sure to do what God has given you to do. But it is to say that we must keep our eyes focused first and foremost on Jesus and not the demands of today. And one of the things that keeps us working so hard with the demands of today is that many of those demands of today are so intimately tied with the dreams and desires of our hearts. And we know that if we can work hard enough and do the right things and keep pressing on with the demands of today, then someday the dreams deep in our hearts will be realized. But the truth is this, hear me. The follower of Jesus Christ does not have the luxury of personal dreams. The follower of Jesus Christ does not have the luxury of personal dreams. I can best explain what I mean by that in a little story that Sarah likes, and I've kind of adopted it as my own, and now I'm going to tell it to you, okay? You may have heard it before, in fact. There's a story of this little girl who's helping her parents at home. And as she helps her parents at home do all her little chores, they give her an allowance. And for weeks and weeks, she saves her allowance until she knows she has enough for the very thing that she's been waiting to purchase. They go to the toy area of the store, and she finds this beautiful, to her, costume jewelry. And she puts on the bracelet, and she puts on the matching necklace. And it becomes one of those things, you know kids who do this, it becomes one of those things that the kid just will not take off. You know, bathes with it on, goes to bed with it on, you know, all of those things. Some of us were those kinds of kids. You know, we just had that really rank pair of shorts or whatever. We wouldn't give up those cowboy boots that even though our feet were too big, we still kept wearing them because they were somehow special to us. She worked so hard, and she got these, and they became very special to her. And one night, her father comes into her room, knocks on the door, as was their custom. He sits down on the edge of the bed with her, and he says, "Honey, I don't remember her name, so let's call her Susie. Susie, you know I love you. Do you think I could have your necklace and your bracelet? I really like them. I'd really like to have them." She says, "Daddy, I really like these. These are mine. I'm sorry, but no, you can't have them." And he says, "Okay, that's fine." And he kisses her on the cheek, and they read a bedtime story, and she goes to sleep. And again, the next night, the same scenario plays out. "Susie, you know I love you. Can I have your necklace and your bracelet?" She bites her lip and says, "Daddy, I love you too. But I want to keep my necklace and my bracelet. I bought these." He says, "Okay, that's fine." And he gives her a kiss on the cheek, and they read. She goes to bed. And this goes on and on, night after night after night, until one evening he walks into her room, and he finds his little girl sitting on the edge of her bed with tears streaming down her face. The necklace isn't on her neck, and the bracelet isn't on her wrist. And through the tears, she looks at her father and says, "Daddy, I really like this necklace. And I really like my bracelet. I worked hard for them. But if you want them, you can have them." So she hands over these prized possessions of hers. And the father kind of nonchalantly takes them. He smiles and he just puts them in his pocket. But he reaches his other hand into his other pocket, and out comes a beautiful, real, grown-up person set of jewelry. the matching bracelet. He reaches around her little neck and he clasps the necklace. And he tells her, I had this all along for you. I was just waiting for you to give me what was yours. The same thing happens with our dreams. We spend so much of our time building and pursuing our own dreams. And it's a lot of effort and it's a lot of painstaking time. And we begin to hear God's own Spirit speak to us and say, you know I love you. Can I have your dream? No, Father. It's mine. It's special to me. You know I love you. Can I have your dream? And when we finally surrender those things to Him, He gives us His dreams. His heart is implanted within us, and we find ourselves pursuing something far greater than we ever could have imagined before. And all along, He was just waiting for us to give Him the cheap thing that we were holding on to so we could have His richness. But you see, when we're pursuing the demands of our dreams, we can allow those very things, as good as they may be, to block our vision of God and where He would lead us. Another shocking thing that Jesus says is found in the following verses, in verses 25 and 26. He says this in verses 25 and 26. I should probably get there. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus. And turning to them, He said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, such a person cannot be my disciple. In a sense, He's telling us that our family can somehow become a thing that blocks our view of God, our family. How could that be? How could our family get in the way? Now, keep in mind, hear this, okay? Jesus is not telling anybody to leave their family, and He's not telling anybody to dishonor their parents. But it becomes a question of who is most important in pursuing Jesus above all else. How does family get in the way? Again, remember, Jesus is talking about pursuing Him more than anything else, loving Him more than anything else. The word hate there doesn't mean abhor. It doesn't mean disdain, the way that many of you feel for the Eagles, I'm sure. He doesn't mean that. He's talking about just simply loving less. Unless you love your parents less than me. The word there is fairly clear that that's the sense that he's saying, but this was heavy stuff in the ancient world. This was deep. Our primary focus cannot be on our family. It must be on God and our relationship with Him. It's a matter of priority. The reason is this. Think in your own life of how much time and energy and emotion and passion and anxiety have been spent trying to get the approval of our family. Following the often poor example of our family. Dealing with the hurt inflicted by our family. Now, families are good. They are gifts from God. Don't take this the wrong way. The issue is when we pursue family above Jesus, when we're trying to make a better family name at the expense of our relationship with God. And this is kind of an aside, but I just want you to hear this today. Because families are funny things. They are great things, but they're kind of funny things too sometimes. Hear me now. God created you with a purpose and a passion. He knew who you would be before He created everything else. He knows you. In His sovereignty, He chose to give you life. With God, there is no such thing as an accidental person. You are not an accident. Your parents may not have planned for you, but you are not an accident. And I say that with sincerity. Because sometimes that's one of the painful things that some of us carry with us. But you see, we have to learn to love Jesus more than our family and stop pursuing those other things. The amazing thing that happens when we do that is this. When we stop pursuing religion for religion's sake, and we stop pursuing pride and building ourselves up, our demands and our dreams, and we stop pursuing family for family's sake, and instead we focus on the King of the ages, and we align our life with what he would lead us to do, all of those other things are put into their rightful place under submission of our hearts to God. And we find that we don't have to work so hard to please God through religion because we're brothers and sisters with Jesus Christ, the one who gave everything for us. And we don't have to work so hard on building ourselves up because we're sons and daughters of the King. And sons and daughters of the King don't have to build up their own name. Sons and daughters of the King are part of a greater family. Sons and daughters of the King have the demands of their dreams taken care of. As I was speaking to the multitude of cars this morning, I was reminded of an activity that my siblings and I used to do. And whenever somebody would get like a fridge or some other large thing that came in a box, we would make cars out of these boxes, okay? Like little kid cars, we'd poke little holes in the bottom and we'd drive around. It was kind of like a little Flintstone car. And we spent hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on these cars. They looked good, if I say so myself. Probably I was a child art prodigy and that just was never recognized. So, you know, I went into the ministry. But not really. I love what I do. Don't take that the wrong way. But we would spend hours with these little cardboard boxes making these cars, and we'd drive around, and one of us would be the cop, and one of us would be the speeder, and, you know, then things would change, and that's just what we did. We spent hours on these cardboard cars. But you know what's amazing about cardboard? How many of you ever left cardboard out in the rain? It becomes like brown paper soup, you know, just kind of this mushy thing that falls apart. The thing about cardboard is that it doesn't last very long. No matter how much effort you put into making something out of cardboard look nice, it's cardboard, and it's going to fall apart. Jesus tells us this through a guy named Paul in 1 Corinthians. I'm just going to read it to you. He says, "If anyone builds on the foundation of Jesus using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, their work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and fire will test the quality of each person's work. If what has been built survives, the builder will receive a reward. If it is burnt up, the builder will suffer loss, but yet will be saved, even though only as one escaping the flames." You see, when we pursue all of those other things, rather than Jesus, when we pursue those other things that should be submitted to him, when we allow religion and family and pride and demands to block our view of God, what happens is we begin building cardboard kingdoms. And on the last day, they burn up or they melt away. But when Jesus is in his rightful place and we're pursuing him above all else as a local church and as individuals, we're building with those things that will never burn up or go away. And Jesus says that not only will we find his rescue, but reward for what we have spent our lives doing in his name. Our call is to build with those things that don't burn up. We can't build that way if our vision is blocked by all of those other things. As you pursue Jesus, wherever you are, and you know, if you're in that place where you're considering following Jesus, I can guarantee you that some of the things that are holding you back were listed today. If you're following Jesus, I can pretty much guarantee you that some of the things that were listed today from time to time begin to creep into your vision. And so I echo what we said at the beginning of this thing, and it's this: be very careful to love the Lord your God. Not because he's going to come after you, but because he does love you. And he has a better way. And he has a way to allow you to build with things that won't burn up and in the end will bring you great reward because he loves you. And if at any point in this today you felt condemned, then that was not the intention. But if you have felt the Holy Spirit of God pointing out some area in your life where your vision is starting to be blocked by one of these things, it's His call to turn to Him and allow Him to cleanse you, to take that out of your vision so you can pursue Him wholeheartedly. What's blocking your view of God and the road that He has you on? I believe if God has been showing you that, He wants to deal with your heart right now, not in a mean way, but in the way a loving father would come and correct and guide his child. So I'm going to give you just a moment in silence to ask the Holy Spirit of God to search and know your heart and to see if any of these things are in you. And if they are, then in your mind's eye to give them over to Him and ask Him to give you clarity of vision. Why don't you just take a moment right now?